It all started in 1971. Michael Douglas was up here shooting with Carl Malden, Streets of San Francisco. And he called up and asked if we still wanted to make One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Well, Saul and I were novices as far as producing came. Many people thought, for instance, that we were crazy to be filming a film in Oregon in January, where it gets dark at 3:30 in the afternoon, where most of the movie takes place inside. And several people asked us, well, why are you filming it up here? Why don't you just go down on a sound stage in Los Angeles or someplace that's much more controllable, rather than trying to, you know, shoot out through the windows and worrying about the light going? But we felt, all of us, and this is really an tribute to Saul, because it was certainly not cost effective, but it was effective as far as creating an environment and a mood.
The producers, I remember that they contacted several hospitals. Michael Douglas and Saul Zanes contacted several hospitals all over the country, but none wanted to receive us because they considered the book, the project, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, not very favorable in describing the practices of the mental health care in those times.
We really loved Milos in large part from a movie he'd done called Fireman's Ball. And Fireman's Ball sort of all took place in this one room where a small town in Czechoslovakia, the firemen were kind of appointing the Queen of the May, the princess, for their ball. And it was a very funny movie, but never laughing at the people. And so Saul and I were both impressed with a man who could juggle multiple characters and find the humor in them without really making fun at their expense.
Dr. Dean Brooks, who was the superintendent of the hospital in Salem, Oregon, I said, yeah, I will let you in to shoot, because I think, under one condition, if you will employ a few of my patients, and I think it could be a therapy. And we agreed, and that's how we got to Salem, Oregon.
And one of the little tricks that we learned is we had our Dr. Dean Brooks read the script and sort of outline what he thought the illnesses were of each of the patients, the actors playing the patients in our film. And then we would put them in actual group sessions, in actual group therapy sessions at the hospital, working with, in our rehearsal period for 2 to 3 weeks before we started shooting, creating an atmosphere and environment where it was hard to separate illusion and reality.
All the patients on this main ward, which you will see, are actors. They are professional actors, including the nurses and the orderlies. And the fact that we are shooting on the grounds of a real mental institution was also very, very, very helpful. Plus, there was another advantage of a low budget. We couldn't afford any names. All the actors, except for the Jack Nicholson part, had to be actors who will be willing to work on scale. That means they all had to be unknown, and they were all unknown in those times. That was good. That was good for the story, because it's a story about a man who, from the world known to us, is entering the world unknown to us. I mean, the mental institution. And it's very proper that this one man is a star. It's Jack Nicholson. It's somebody we know, we can identify with, and through his eyes, more or less, we are seeing suddenly a world unknown to us. And that's very, very good, because I wanted the audience not to know any face. Everybody is unknown to the audience in this world. This hospital was a big complex which could house over 1,000 patients. But in those times, there were only over 200 or 300 patients in the whole hospital. So this one whole ward was given to us for our purposes, so that we can move around and shoot whatever we wanted, wherever we wanted, whenever we wanted. What was also very important that the fact that we were shooting in the mental institution was we brought the actors in about 1 week before we started the actual shooting. And what I did was I ascribed for every actor one particular patient.
God damn, boy.
And all I did, I asked the actor, just follow this person, follow this man, and just look how he walks, how he talks, how he behaves. I was not interested in, analyzing the mental illness or whatever medical, problems they could have.
They sat a lot of times with the permission of the hospital in therapy sessions with other patients, watching behavior. We would choose certain patients that sort of had some of the qualities that each of that actors might have, and they would watch and study that patient while they were in the therapy session.
Ha ha ha! That's old Charlie Cheswick's car.
That's his ace of spades. Your turn, Bill.
You know what? I remember that when I was doing the research for the film, and I more or less for the first time entered the mental institution, what was the most shocking for me was that I was expecting these poor souls, doing all kind of crazy things, like, hanging from the chandeliers and begging themselves in their chest, proclaiming, "I am Jesus Christ," and things like that. I didn't see any of that. What was the most surprising is that I saw these people who were desperately trying to look normal.
Ever seen this one?
Come on, Martini.
Martini.
Martini, will you? Will you play a cup?
Whose turn is it now?
Well, it's a heat trunk. Where are you going?
Aren't you going to play?
What's the matter with...
Aren't you going to play Martini? Martini? I want to play.
You got it. It's your lead.
Billy? What's... Billy, I want to win some cards.
Get a grip on yourself, will you?
And this is Dr. Dean Brooks. He is the actual superintendent of the hospital.
Have him come in.
And what we did here, this scene is more or less improvised. What we did was, I gave Dr. Brooks a report on McMurphy, report as if it was prepared in the correctional institution for him. And this is the first time he saw it, when the cameras were rolling. And I just told him, just do your job, as if this is your new patient.
It was Milos's idea. One day he came up and he said, "What do you think about about Dean playing the part?" And we smiled and thought that would be great if he could do it. And so we went up and auditioned him and thought he'd be great.
And Jack knew that he has to go from a point A to point B to point C, but how he will get from point A to point Z, that was left up to him.
Randall Patrick McMurphy.
Milos said to Dean Brooks, he said, "Look, you admit patients, you go down the list. Go down the list, Jack will answer your questions." And of course, Jack, half the things were totally off the wall, like hitting the fly. There's no fly there, trying to con him and everything else. It was done beautifully. We had 18, 20 minutes, which we didn't want to give up, and cut down to six, I think.
No, go right ahead.
Also, what was what was very beneficial for the film was the collaboration with the hospital that during the writing of the script with Bo Goldman and before with Larry Hauben, you know, I spent, as a matter of fact, with Larry Hauben, we lived for about 4 weeks on the grounds of the hospital, and I spent a lot of time with Bo Goldman on the grounds of the hospital, you know, walking around, observing things, observing the patients, observing the situation, and I think that this collaboration helped a lot, that the script really soaked with the authenticity of the place.
As I can figure out, it's because I fight and fuck too much.
I knew of Ken Kesey then. I lived in San Francisco.
Why did you get
Ken Kesey was well known. And I was working for the record company. We were recording Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Rex Roth, and all the poets and jazz in the cellar, Michael McClure, and those guys.
Two, three, four. You've got at least five arrests for assault.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that?
Five fights, huh? Rocky Marciano's got 40 and he's a millionaire.
It was a strange situation at the beginning because first I read the book and I loved the book and that's what I responded to Saul and Michael. Yes, I want to make this movie. Then they sent me a script which was written by Ken Kesey. I read the script, and it was another version of the book. It was not a film script.
But it's all right. He wrote a great book and never said anything different about it. That he did write a great book. Well, and Kirk Douglas came up with a great line to Michael. Michael told me his father said to him, "Well, what did you expect?" He said he did one miracle. He performed one miracle in his life. You're saying perform another miracle. Write a great script, which is totally different than what he's doing before.
Then I got Larry Hauben's script, which was much closer to something what film should look like, and we worked on it for several weeks, and then we ran out of steam together, and I still was not satisfied. And that's when Bo Goldman came in, and it was a wonderful collaboration, because with Bo, I had this chance to act out everything and play out, you know, because when you sit down and write the dialogue, fine, it reads very well, very often, and then when you hear the dialogue for the first time, when in front of the cameras, and suddenly you realize, well, it read well, but it doesn't sound really right. It's a literature. It's not the way people speak. Then you panic, and so I like in the process of writing, working on the script with the writer, that we can act all the scenes out, so I can hear the lines, I can hear them, I can try to understand how close they are to the normal way people talk and express themselves, which is very important for the credibility of when it comes to a story which you want people to believe the characters.
I think we ought to get to the bottom of R.P. McMurphy.
I was nervous about shooting this therapy session scenes because there are several in the movies, I don't know, four or five, and there are long scenes where practically nothing is happening except that there is a big nurse and then in semi-circle is sitting nine patients and all they are doing is talking. So what I did was I asked always to use two cameras, not to crisscross. They were both on the side of the big nurse. And I used one camera always through the whole scene fixed on one patient. If it's McMurphy or if it's Billy Bibbit or some other patients, while the other camera I instructed to roam around the semicircle of the patients and just, you know, catch as catch can the moments, to stay for a while on this patient and then move to another patient and then to another one. And that proved to be very, very beneficial. Because if I was shooting only one camera, then only that one actor who is in the focus of that camera would feel the burden of performing perfectly, while the others can take it a little more easy, you know, just to help by saying the lines or whatever. But they know that they are not being seen, that they wouldn't feel necessarily to be entirely in their role. But because none of them knew at what moment they will be on the camera, they had to be through the whole scene on their toes, to be always in the character, which was very helpful to that one actor who had to play, from them and of them, and who was the main focus of that one particular take.
We knew from the first group therapy session that there was an atmosphere that was so real. The screenplay by Bo Goldman and Larry Hobman was ringing so true. And the performances were, you just couldn't take your eyes off of anybody. And nobody ever stopped. There was never a bad take. You could use any one of them. It was just a question of choices.
I also realized one thing, that here, it's, if I want these scenes to be interesting and the audience,
Mr. Chesley,
not to bore the audience with them, that I have to get on the screen a very interesting human behavior.
Me?
And yes. That's usually much more pronounced when people are not talking.
You mean there's not
and they are reacting an only. On this matter. And that was the second camera catching on the during the shooting of these scenes.
Mr. Harding,
It was not easy on the cameraman, on the director of photography, because he had to light the space practically that 180% 180 degree of the space has to be lit so that it's usable in the film for that wandering camera. And because when you are shooting in the real location, you know, you don't have the height of the studio where you can hide and hang how many lights or lamps you wish. Here, you know, we had a rather low ceiling, so that whole job of lighting the scenes was rather elaborate and very, very cleverly done by the cameraman I worked with, mainly with Haskell Wexler.
To another, the form and the content.
Harding, why don't you knock off the bullshit and get to the point?
This is the point. This is the point, Taper. It's not bullshit.
You know, the fact I was talking before about the decision to choose all unknown actors for everybody in the film except for the main character, for the Jack Nicholson character, was also good that I had a chance to really orchestrate the physicalities of these actors, because there are a lot of secondary roles in this film, and it is very important that I am always very disturbed when I see a film and I'm mixing characters because they look alike, they're they're similar physicalities. So it's very important that I have a chance to really orchestrate all these patients. That once you see the face, you will never forget who he is, who she is, and always will, you will never be taken out of following the story by guessing, who is that? Did I see him before? Was it this one or that one?
Mr. Harding, they all ganging up on you.
It was a very unique environment, and we were very fortunate. And this is one of those qualities of a production that you never would understand unless you were there. And this is why it paid off in spades for us to be filming up at this hospital. The other thing is that you could never get away from your work, which is sometimes good, and create this environment. You cannot just, you know, walk out the door at the end of the day. We actually, during the rehearsal period, we had some actors who actually spent the night in the wards, in the sets that we were in, just getting used to the whole environment. So by the time Jack Nicholson arrived, because he came into the rehearsal period late because of a previous commitment, another picture, and we were rehearsing the first day, and these actors never broke character. So I remember we stopped for lunch, and we're having lunch in the little cafeteria in the hospital, and Jack looked around, and we were all nervous with our star on his first day. He kind of looked around, he pushed his tray back and just rushed outside, taking a deep breath of air. And I went out to see him. I said, "Jack, what's wrong? What's wrong?" And he said, "Who are these guys? Who are they? I mean, don't they break character for lunch? They don't even stop for lunch." And that was the kind of feeling that we had a reality going that really paid off once we started filming.
We started out thinking we could cast an Indian, find an Indian. And then we found out very quickly that Indians are not normally very tall. Now, we're talking about tall, big, and an actor. Someone who can act or understand. So, yeah, this is quite a package. So we visited New York. We visited the Iroquois Mohawks work on the big buildings, iron workers. The union is almost all of them. We went to the union and we saw a lot of guys. I don't think there was one over 5'9".
We were having a very difficult time fulfilling the role of the chief in the novel and trying to find somebody who had this sort of quality. And I'll never forget when we flew up to Salem, Oregon, via Portland, Saul, myself, Milosh, and Jack Nicholson. And we were bringing Jack up to read with Dr. Dean Brooks to see if he could actually play the part of the doctor in the movie. At the same time, he'd gotten this tip on this forest fire ranger from Yakima, Washington, an artist with a painting in the Smithsonian, Will Sampson.
You don't move. Now, take the ball.
And one of the strongest memories I'll ever remember was us waiting at the Portland airport from this flight from Yakima, Washington, and the passengers started coming off the plane, and all of a sudden there was Will. In his cowboy boots and cowboy hat, he was pretty close to 7 feet.
What the hell you talking to him for? He can't hear a fucking thing.
And Jack just looked and went, "Oh my God, oh my God, there he is, the chief, the chief." We got so excited, we started shaking. Can he talk? Can he talk? And then he said, "Oh no, that's right, he doesn't have to talk. He doesn't have to talk." And he came off and we just stared at him, and originally we were just going to have a meeting right there at the airport, and then Will was going to go back to Yakima, where we liked him so much. We got him to jump in this little small plane we had to fly down to Salem, but there wasn't enough seats, so Jack had to sit on Will's lap on the plane. And I never forget, Jack looked like this little boy in this big guy's hands. He kept staring at him. He said, the chief, I don't believe it.
Put it in the basket, chief. Jump up and dunk it in.
And at the airport, here comes in Will Sampson, this tall, very proud-looking, great Indian. And I was so excited when I saw him, but can he act? So I said, "Well, listen, let's go to Salem and let's ask Dr. Dean Brooks and let's ask Jack to join us and to do some readings." And Jack agreed, so we went there and...
Hit me, chief! I got the move!
And I don't think I was ever more nervous, because if this will not work out, I don't know what to do with the film. We didn't have an Indian.
Take the ball, you
and
jump
it up. Was like, you know, music from heaven when he opened. He was a very intelligent man. He was a rodeo rider in his youth, and he injured himself badly. He couldn't continue as a rodeo rider, and he became a very good artist. I saw his drawings of nature, of trees and animals, and they were rather remarkable. He was a very intelligent, soft-spoken man, with great instincts, and that was it. The film was saved.
Basket cheese! Put it in the basket!
Jack can be funny. A fine actor. A great, I think he's probably the greatest screen actor of the last 25 years. You know, when you look what an actor has to be, he's the greatest improviser of all. He can improvise in time, period, I'm talking about, in the situation, in the script, the character of the guy, and the script itself. He just dropped in lines and things like that that made the scene. There's a scene in the, they're playing back blackjack, and he's dealing, and he's gonna an eight for Mr. So-and-so, and he says, a ten as big as his wang, I think he says, for Billy Bibbit, who's a shy kid now. So you realize what he's saying to him, and Billy Bibbit looks at him, but reacting to the line, because he didn't know what he was going to say. That's not in the script at all.
Understand. All right, here they come. Queen to the Chesser, big bull to tablations, ten to Billy to match his wang.
It's street talk of that time, using the word wang. I hadn't heard the word in 20 years or 30 years before that. And dropping in the right place for the right guy. And that went on all the time with Jack. He wouldn't do it just to throw something in to show that he could do it. He did it because he felt right about it, and he was right 95% of the time.
23 up, Cheswick. All right, Tabor, you're busted. Give me this.
23.
Huh? The casting process on Cuckoo's Nest was pretty unique. It was easy in the sense that we could create a group therapy scene, which would be the audition. And let's say there were eight actors in that scene. And what we would do is, let's say if we came out of New York, we would start maybe with eight different group therapy scenes. That means eight different actors playing each of those roles. And then from that group, those eight groups, then we would narrow down to four groups, right? And the same thing was going on the West Coast in California. This is how the auditioning process went. So from the four groups, then we would pick everything else down to two groups. And the same thing. So we finally ended up with one full group of different actors for the parts in New York, and one full group of different actors in Los Angeles. Then, in this kind of picture with so many cast members, you then have two elements that are important to you, because they're all good actors, but now it becomes a physicality question. Who has a beard? Who has gray hair? Who looks right for the part? How do you help differentiate the characters? Everybody looks different from each other, number one. And two, compatibility. Because at one point, not only do you want a good actor, but you want somebody who you could be living with in the trenches for the next 4 months. And that was sort of the process that came down. Certain characters like Danny DeVito playing Martini was set pretty early, so he would audition with most all of the groups, like from New York. He would be the Martini that we would use, because we were already preset on him. But I think that process, a lot of it came out of the fact that we had to wait for Jack. So we spent almost 6 months casting. And it paid off, because I think what helped make that picture stand out was the reality of these characters and how right each of them was for their part.
Milos is the best
director
at casting that I've ever seen. There's a few other great ones too, of course, at casting, and some who don't care much. They just want a body. But Milos will have some readings. He'd come with the Milos Forman line. He says, well, I haven't been long in this country. You have to forgive me. I'm not familiar with your acting. He said, would you be so kind as to attend some readings? You know, and they come, because they know, most of them want to do it. They want readings. And we used to have readings in New York with Danny DeVito, Chris Lloyd, Vinnie Scavelli, Bill Redfield, a few other guys, and all of those attended the reading. We had great times reading the lines and everything else. Danny DeVito got on a chair at one of the readings the first time. And I remember everyone was in character at the readings. And one time, Chris Lloyd didn't do it because he had to go for an audition. And I read his lines, and Danny was next to me. And he said, "Got time for a cup of coffee?" You know, like he was being that character, asking me if he, asking me, but doing things all around, all the time. And Danny is a good, serious actor. And Chris Lloyd, it was, I saw Chris Lloyd do with Meryl Streep. They starred in a Kurt Vile play called Happy End, a block or two off Broadway. And they starred in, he broke his leg 2 weeks before it was supposed to open and rehearsal. But he wasn't going to give up the part. He was on stage with the cast just moving around under his pants.
You know, that was
I just saw Vinny Scavelli last week in L.A. And I see Danny every now and then. We talk. And Chris I see fairly often, too. And then back east, we see a few others as often as we can. And we see a lot of the crew, too. And Jack I see every now and then. Jack attends all our screenings in L.A. And that, for Jack, that's something. That's his way of saying yes.
Watch. What do you say to that? You want to bet? No, you want to bet? 1 week. It's all I need. Who wants to bet? You want to bet? Bet a buck. $1. Huh? I'll bet. Caves. In $1. Solid.
Last time we were discussing Mr. Harding and the problem with his wife, and I think we were making a lot of progress. So who would like to
another
today?
Therapy session. You know, there was one more thing which was very important for all the actors to concentrate on.
Thinking about what you said about...
how should I put it? To forget about this kind of a bad mannerism which somehow television is influencing very much in the acting. Which pronounces itself in this kind of a line, you know, rapid rhythm of in the dialogue, because that kills the fascination and watching a human behavior. So constantly, I was reminding the actors, just take your time. You know, it's in real life, we don't have our lines ready. We didn't learn them before we go and talk to somebody. You know, we have to think, we have to react, we have to reflect. And, you know, when you watch people in real life, you realize how much the face is interesting sometimes more to read the face than to listen to the lines. And that was very important, especially for this for the scenes where we can watch, you know, the how the face talks.
Milos,
hey guys,
would look at the guy. A guy would do some scrimmage. He says, "Why do you do that? Nobody talks like that. You know, talking, you got your mouth full of something." He said, "What are you talking about?" Or he'd say to the guy, the actor, like he did in Amadeus to an actor, he says, "You're bullshitting." He said, "You're giving me that stage bullshit." He said, "You can't lie to the camera. Camera is more real than the stage, which is real." He said, "The camera looks into your eyes and sees your heart." He said, "You can't do this." And Zachter came off, was a good friend of mine, and his face was bright red. He says, after a couple minutes, he says, "I could have killed him. I could have killed him then." He says, "But then I realized he was right. I was thinking of something else. I wasn't thinking of the lines of the other person of the story."
My turn. Okay, hot dice.
This is the only scene during which, during the shooting of the last take, I had a conflict with Jack Nicholson. That was the only time we yelled at each other. And it was because, you know, I don't now remember if it was just, I think we had just one day or or 2 days to shoot the scene, which is rather elaborate, and the time was running out, and I wanted to do some, you know, close-ups, cutaways, and the light was going down outside the windows, and so that last shot in the scene, you know, usually I do always, I repeat the same take at least 3-4 times, rarely more, but at least 3 times. But this time, you know, it looked fine, we had no problem with the labs, so that they would, you know, destroy the negative, so, you know, I did one take, and I said, good, that's enough. And Jack suddenly said, no, I was not good enough. And I needed the time. So I said, no, you were good enough, let's move the camera. So they started to move the camera. Jack got angry. It was a good conflict, because usually the fights occur when I said, that was not good enough, let's do it again. Why? I did it good, I did it well. You know, we did it enough. This was the other way around. And I was very, as angry as I was, as happy I was, because that showed that Jack, you know, really cared a lot when we were doing this movie.
Mac, you can't get out of here. Anybody want to bet?
We spent a long time just trying to figure out on Lifting the Fountain as to how to incorporate it. You know, it was something we had to sort of set up earlier in scenes, and that's where we had when they're playing cards and everything on there to sort of set up this fountain beforehand, so it wouldn't come out of left field. But again, it was one of those scenes that was a famous scene in the novel. And as Milos would say, you know, it's much easier to make a good movie out of a bad book than to make a good movie out of a good book. Because when there's a good book, people's expectations are so high, they have their own visions of how they see it, and you usually disappoint them.
Yeah, this was a very important scene for the film. That's why the tensions were rising, you know, and came to that blowout with Jack, because this is the scene where we have to register and remember to the end of the film that strange object in the middle of a tub room, which Jack is in vain trying to lift, and we have to register that look at the Indian's face, watching it, so that we don't understand that ending of the film.
Given up?
No, just warming up, warming up, warming up. This will be the one. All right, baby. Come on, get your head on. What are you doing?
And Jack couldn't lift. That was Jack. Those are red. The scrapes on his arms he had from trying to lift it. He really was scraping both arms. Jack didn't know. He won. I'm supposed to do that. I'm going to try and get this son of a bitch off.
And again, that was one of those scenes that we thought, will we ever be able to, you know, accomplish it with the same drama and importance of the novel? And Milos did, but I tried. God damn it, I tried. It was sort of the key element of what this movie's all about.
But I tried, didn't I? God damn it! At least I did that.
And on the mound, the left-hander Al Downing. The two pitchers still warming up, right down below. Second game of the 1963 World Series is being brought to you from Yankee Stadium.
Did you tell the girl how you felt about her?
over to her house one Sunday afternoon.
This kind of situations when you are shooting on locations are driving the directors of photography crazy. You can see the windows, right? Here is pretty, you can see the light, it's pretty bright day outside, but you shoot this whole scene. It took, I don't know, a day or two to shoot the scene, and you can, if you watch really carefully, you see how difficult it is to control the same kind of mood behind the windows, because the weather changes during the day. You know, it's for a while it's sunny, then it comes clouds, and it's raining, you know. But on the film, you either have to feel that it's the same all the time, or just you have to do it the way that nobody notices these changes, which I think was accomplished by the cinematographer. By this time, the actors were already in their roles so perfectly that I didn't even have to talk to them, you know. They were just, they knew the lines, they sit around, they knew that the one camera is roaming around, they have to be in their roles all the time, and I even didn't have to talk to them.
Billy, wasn't that the first time you tried to commit suicide?
Well, Michael and I had seen the play in San Francisco at a small theater, which was owned by Francis Ford Coppola, the little Fox 99-seat theater. And we were really taken by the play. It had very good actors in it. Johnny Weissmuller Jr. played the Indian. And the play moved you. It ran there for 5 or 6 years, or maybe even 7 years. And I had seen it a few times. And then when we talked to Jack about it, about coming up to see the play, He said he didn't need to see the play because he had read the book and the script, and he loved them both, and he thought that was all he would need. And I kept making a pain in the ass out of myself by bugging him about it. We'd see him about once a week or every 2 weeks in L.A. and talk about the play. Milos and Michael Douglas and I were still working on the screenplay a little bit, and every time I saw him, I would ask him about coming up. And finally, after a few months, he said, okay, I'll come up. And he came up, and we saw the play. He and I went to see it, and just after the second act started, he reached over and grabbed my leg just above the knee and squeezed it and whispered in my ear. He said, "Saul, we're going to become rich," which was lovely because it's Jack Nicholson, the essence of Jack, the tough guy, telling you that this picture reached my heart. You know, the play reached my heart, and I knew it was something else. It wasn't just about money, because he took less money to make the picture. Ended up making a lot, but he took less. And he wanted to do it, and that gave him something else that made him realize what he was going to become a part of.
Okay, I want to see the hands. Come on. Which one of you nuts has got any guts? All right. Sit.
I only count 9 votes, Mr. McMurphy.
He only counts 9. Only 9. It's a landslide.
There are 18 patients on this ward, Mr. McMurphy. And you have.
I really didn't know Jack Nicholson before this picture started. I know everybody thinks that he was so right for the part, but you have to remember that before Cuckoo's Nest, Jack was sort of acknowledged as this sort of sensitive, young, educated man in either like 5 Easy Pieces, Easy Rider, sort of an educated man, and no one thought of him having sort of the gruffness and the size that R.P. McMurphy needed. And then it was at a time when Hal Ashby, a wonderful director, showed us some film of The Last Detail, which was a picture he did with Jack, where Jack played a lifer sailor, where we got a sense of that kind of burliness and that quality. And it was also after, I might say, that 2 other actors who we thought were more appropriate for the part had turned the part down. Gene Hackman and Marlon Brando.
Huh?
You know, both at that time, for different reasons, you know, turned it down. And Jack, you know, always had a very good, you know, nose, eyes, and ears for material. He knows when it's right, and this was something he'd always really, really wanted to do.
Gene Hackman was the second choice, and Gene would have been very good at it. But Gene Hackman's agent never gave him the screenplay and told him it wasn't for him, it wasn't going to be good, and we probably would never make the picture and he'd be wasting his time, and all of that crap they usually tell their clients and when they don't want them to do something. And after she saw it, she went to a screening and Michael Douglas was there. After the screening, she said to Michael, "Gene's going to kill me when he sees this picture."
All right, just wait a minute, will you? Just 1 minute.
You can bring the subject up again tomorrow.
All right, Chief. You're our last chance. What do you say, huh? Just raise your hand up. That's all we need from you today, Chief. Just raise your hand up one time. Show her that you can do it. Just show her that you can still do it. Just raise your hand up. All the guys have got them up. Just raise your hand up, Chief, will you? Huh? Come on. There's got to be one guy in here that's not a total fucking nut.
Mac?
Well, one of the biggest
the
secrets, I think, about Jack Nicholson as an actor is that he does a lot of homework, but you never see it. And as someone who lived next door to Jack for several months, I can tell you the number of evenings when his lights were on really late, and he wasn't doing anything else but like working on the part. And yet when he comes in the next day, he makes it all appear as if it's, you know, just by chance. And that's part of his real talent. And that baseball sequence he worked on religiously.
Now, you're not going to say that now. You're going
to
pull that.
I used to be a big baseball fan, and I still am a baseball fan, sports fan. Well, there's a scene where he's doing the announcing the baseball game on TV. The picture takes place in 1963, and this is 1975. Now we're shooting. And he's got the batting order of the Yankees in his head, and what they did. This guy singled to right, so-and-so, and ball players that I had forgotten existed. Tommy Trash is the shortstop, and some other guys were with the Yankees at that time. I thought, that is great, really is great. He came up with it. It was his homework he did.
Koufax? Koufax kicks. He delivers. It's up the middle, it's a base hit.
The imaginary baseball game was one of the most brilliant pieces of acting I've seen in a long time, and it went on even longer than what you see on the screen. Jack had a game in his mind and played it out and played the players and all of that, and did an incredible job of sort of seducing all the other patients into believing there was a game. And most of what we did, it wasn't, because of the rehearsal time we spent, it was like you could have taken the first take and used them. It was great.
Somebody give me a fucking wiener before I die.
And then they started adding that line, "Somebody give me a wiener before I die." You know, it's just great coming up with those lines.
This scene, the doctors in this scene are actual doctors from the hospital. As a matter of fact, this young doctor you will see here a few years later, it was a tragic event. He was killed by one of the patients, this doctor.
She ain't honest. Oh, now look, Miss Ratchett's one of the finest nurses we've got in this institution.
I just talked to him a few weeks ago. Yeah, Dean Brooks, yeah. Oh, he's a wonderful man, and bright and brilliant and touching, and see him walking through a ward, the older persons, and what we learned about psychiatry and mental illness up there just by being there. And there are a lot of women in this ward they all came around, and he said to one of them, and hi, doctor, and he says, hi, Mary. He knew the names of like 6, 7, 8, or 10 of them, and she said, well, you promised me a kiss if I was good this week, and if I did so-and-so. And he says, well, she said, I did, of course I did it. And he gave her a kiss in the cheek, and another one said, what about me? And he said, now, Marianne, you know, I didn't promise you anything. So she said, but I would like a kiss. And he kissed her on the cheek.
Rolling stone gathers no moss.
Yeah?
Does that mean something to you?
It's the same as don't wash your dirty underwear in public.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
I'm smarter than him, ain't I? Well, that sort of was always meant is, it's hard for something to grow on something that's moving.
How did you feel about what happened yesterday?
He said, it's wonderful what it's done for psychiatry and doctors throughout the country, which is, it's hard to describe the feelings it gives you without sounding wrong about it. It's just, it's so emotional to hear from the people who say it, patients, guys with patients up there, patients from all over the world, and meeting a few stop you in a hotel and a lobby and say, are you so, I want to tell you something, and they start, you know, and it's just so moving, and he has been moved by patients writing to him that he said, I would never have known about it if they didn't write.
This Oregon State Mental Hospital had a lot of empty wings. So with even our large cast, we were happy to give each of them their own private dressing room, except it was a private cell in the hospital. So they had gates on them and all that, which we would leave open. And we set up one of the recreation rooms with a pool table and a ping pong table to kind of hang out. And then on the other floors, we had the editing equipment set up right there on other floors so they could be working on the editing, and a screening room set up. So when work was finished, we could just go right upstairs and see what the dailies were from the day before. And there was a lot because the scenes were long. There was a lot of coverage. But I can't ever remember a movie where you never got tired of watching the dailies because it all was good. There was just hardly anything that didn't work.
Well, this is double, of course. You know, we couldn't risk that something would happen to Jack.
Well, Saul, you know, bless his soul, this picture was a tight budget, which progressively got a lot larger. And I think he was under a fair amount of pressure from his other partners or investors at Fantasy Records and Films, because basically all the kind of profits and everything from the record company were going into making this movie. I remember at one point he got very nervous and he started going around collecting all the bottles. He started collecting all the bottles he had for refunds as a sign or symbol to show that this was not going to be a you know, superfluous kind of film production. We all looked at him, and we thought, well, maybe he lost it, but he was doing it in the sense of sort of set the tone, but it was very funny.
Milos thought that he wanted to shoot the whole thing in the hospital or on the grounds. The basketball game would be there, but to be on the grounds, they'd never get out. He said, because it was cheating to have him go out. And I pointed out to him that even in this hospital, they took them on mountain climbing trips, the patients, they took them on different things that you would never think you would take them, you know, and fishing too. And I'm sure Ken Kesey got it in a book from reality, from some place doing it. And but he didn't want to do it, and I kept bugging him. And finally he said, all right, we'll put it in. But if it doesn't work, I'm taking it out. And I looked at him and said, look, Milos, when haven't you taken it out if it didn't work? You know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So he did it, and I never said anything about it. The guys, Arthur Krim and Pletzko, I was seeing them in New York, And the Arthur Grimm said, I got to tell you, this is my favorite scene in the picture, the boat scene. He said, Milo told me, no, he said it wouldn't be in the picture, it was up to me. So it kept bothering me.
You all crazy?
We were incredibly lucky with the scenes, you know. It's you see the puddles here? It was raining and raining and raining, and this was the last scene we had to shoot. We had nothing else to shoot. We finished shooting in the hospital, and the day we arrived in the Depot Bay, which is again in Oregon, suddenly the sun was out, blue skies, exactly for 1 week, which took us to shoot the scene, and it was unbelievable. We were shooting the last take, and during that one take, suddenly clouds came, sun was gone, and the next half an hour started to rain again. But we had the scene in the can.
Stand around for here. Get on board, Gibbons.
Mel Lambert is the harbor master, and Mel was the man who found us Will Sampson.
What are you doing on this boat?
We're going fishing.
No, you're not going fishing. Not on this boat. You're not going fishing on this boat.
Oh, yeah, on this boat.
Mel is was a used car salesman in Salem, Oregon, whose father used to be an Indian agent. And so all the Indians would come to buy a car from Mel because he was the only one the Indians could trust. He also was a rodeo announcer. He used to do a lot of rodeo announcing. And I flew back on an airplane with Mel Lambert long before the movie started, where he was telling me about his background. And I said, hey, look, if you ever run across a big, you know, big Indian, we're looking for a really kind of tall Indian, you know, please let us know. And he said, sure. He's on his way to a rodeo announcing trip. And about 4 months later, I get a call. It says, Michael, this is Mel Lambert and Mel Lambert Motors. Jesus, Michael, the biggest son of a bitch you ever seen in your life walked. And this Indian is big. I think he's just the guy you're looking for. And that was Will.
You better quit on this. They'll throw you in the can again, you know.
No, they won't. We're nuts. They'll just take us back to the feed farm, see?
Von Seefeld, get the stern line. Tapes, you're at the bow.
This one?
I could see it as a film. I know it, we seem to have an affinity in making pictures, and most of them come from books or plays, just about all of them. It's because reading a book, you can see something. You don't know how to do it, but you can feel the power in the book. And you know there's, once you find the central focus of it, place that takes you through the book, through the story you're trying to tell, then you could write all around it, the center of it. And once we found that out there, you have to have a story first. What is the story that you want to tell? It's still storytelling. You hear people say it and you think, oh, well, they're just saying it. They're just saying it because it's true.
This was a tough scene because sooner or later everybody got seasick, and you can see it's a small boat, so they have, you know, 9 actors there, and the film crew and a camera. For example, here I couldn't use 2 cameras because there was no space. As a matter of fact, most of the time that one camera was rigged on some kind of a construction which was hanging outside of the boat, on a stern. So it was pretty elaborate and depressing because every day somebody was just vomiting his life out.
Danny was very sick. Danny got very sick, probably as sick as anyone. But the Chris Lloyd got sick, then the Vinny too, they got sick. But you get used to it.
This is the base.
After a pretty healthy debate with Milos about this boat sequence, about going out on this boat. We decided that it was an important sequence and the movie needed to get outside a little bit.
Originally, I was wrong. I didn't want to have this scene in the film because I thought that it will help the ending if the whole film will be taking place just inside the four walls of the hospital. Almost a claustrophobic movie that at the end when the Indian suddenly, you know, breaks the window and leaves the hospital, that relief of being outside will be much stronger. But that was the producers, you know, the Solzens mainly, who was sort of saying, oh, I'd like, I feel sorry that scene. And I was thinking about it and then find, okay, let's shoot it and then I can, you know, we can cut it out at the end. And but then I was very, very happy that we shot this scene.
Wait a second, get it through the eyes. Here.
And I knew that the film, you know, it's going to be long. That was one of the reasons, and the editing was very crucial for this film, to give it the right pace and without being boring and give the length. And the first cut was like, I don't know, 3 hours, but that's always like that. For the first cut, it's always, you know, you put everything in. And then I was, you know, I started to cut it down, and it was down to about, I don't know, 2 hours and 25 minutes, and still felt a little too long, and I was going crazy, so I just, you know, chopped everything unimportant out. And this, you know, I am referring now to the moments which I described how important they are for the film, which is, you know, to see the people when they are not talking, when they are reacting, when they are behaving, just to watching the human behavior. I cut it all that out. I cut it the television style, you know, line. I cut it down under 2 hours. And you know what was funny? It felt much longer. It felt suddenly like 4 hour long film because you didn't give the audience, I didn't give myself a chance to get know these people, to identify with them. And the moment you start to identify with people and get really interested in their stories, you forget about time. You just follow the story. I didn't give this time to learn enough about these people from their behavior to the audience, so everything felt long. So I put back like 13 or 15 minutes, and the film was like 2 hour, I don't know, it's like 2 hour, 9 minutes, something like that, and suddenly it felt right.
We had an editor, a first-time editor, or a second-time, Lindsay Klingman, who's become a very well-known top editor. And in Denmark, we were on a press conference and somebody said, that scene with so-and-so was a wonderful scene, the way you put it together. He said, well, he said, I wish it was my idea. He said, but a girl named Lindsay Klingman came up with it, which was great, because here she's 7,000 miles away, and he's giving her credit. And I never had the chance, I had met her once after that, but I never had the chance to tell her till about 7-8 years ago, and I told her, and she started to cry right then about that he did that.
And I remember as we got closer to the times, and this is now probably March, we got weather reports that there was a hurricane that was going to be hitting the Oregon coast right around the time that we were going to be going down there. And it's the only time I think we've been fortunate that we actually fell a little bit behind schedule, because sure enough, the day that we were supposed to be there, it came through like a terror. And about 2 days later, we got down there, and it was calm after the storm, and it was fine, it was beautiful, and we got through that shooting without any major problems, except for the fact that half of the cast, those who were from New York, never been on a boat in their life, and they got so seasick. They were so seasick, and we had to go out for like 5 or 6 days, and we had to literally hold these guys, hold them around their arms, and push them on the boat crying because they couldn't go out and do it one more day because they were so sick, but they did it.
Thank you.
was standing next to Angelica there on the dock, and I had a pea coat and a watch cap. We were extras. We were on the dock, so they promised us $25 a day and then never paid us. And I got screwed out of my money. That's Hollywood for you. Angelica and I are just waiting for the interest to reach $200,000, which will be soon, I think, on that $25. Milos is a brilliant casting person. Not only physically, you have to believe him. Before they are, his philosophy is if a guy comes through the door who's supposed to be a doctor and he looks like he might be a doctor, he becomes a pretty good actor then without, before he says a word, because you believe he's a doctor. And it's true.
In this scene also, this people are all members of the staff at the mental institution, the doctors.
Dr. Sanji?
All the doctors, all the guys who played doctors in the film were doctors.
Well, I still think
we knew them and talked to them all the time, and talked about many things, because we were locked in with them. Patients, doctors, orderlies, nurses, and us were there like 12 hours a day.
Well, I think we've had our turn. I'd like to send him back to the work farm, frankly.
What was surprising to me, and to all of us educational, Michael and I were with Dean, and I asked him, what percentage of the patients are on drugs? He said, just about none of them. He said, there's some violent ones upstairs, he said, that we have to keep on drugs, but on this floor, they're just about none. He says, because after all, how could we know who and what they are if we had them on drugs?
Send them up to disturbed. It's just one more way of passing on our problem to somebody else. You know, we don't like to do that. So I'd like to keep him on the ward. I think we can help him.
This was a very important line.
All right.
Because,
Chief. Chief. Come on. Come with me, huh?
From right. My own life experience, every conscious or subconscious evil in man always acts in an effort to help people. And that was the leading factor in the final decision of casting Big Nurse to give this part to Louise Fletcher, who is a brilliant actress and a wonderful, wonderful lady, so gentle and sweet. And at the first moment, she was not the exact image of this big nurse, which, as it's described in the book, you know, foam coming out of her nostrils and wires sticking out of her hair and this, you know, personification of a real evil and brutality. It's much more interesting to discover an evil in the with an angel's face. It gives you much more suspense. And it's much more frightening to realize that somebody whom, judging by the way the person looks and talks and behaves, you would never, never suspect that this person can harm you in any way. And I think that this, you know, this big nurse, like many people who do a lot of damage in to our lives, are not even aware. They just would like to help. They know, they are sure, they are so sure they are right in doing what they are doing.
From the first day of dailies, we knew this was good. We did not know what kind of audience was going to be there for a picture about a mental hospital, because everybody had told Saul and I, well, nobody wants to see another snake pit. I wish we'd done our homework to find out that Snake Pit was quite a commercially successful film. But I don't think anybody saw, as we did, the humor that was in this poignant story.
Everybody laughed to shoot this scene because the water was really warm.
Jack is just fabulous. He's fabulous to be with. He's been hours or takes in the water in the swimming sequence where the guy with the pole, Nathan Washington, was poking him saying, get back, do this or whatever. It's like 14 takes. And Jack stayed in the water all the time. He came out, he was Mr. Prune.
By the time you get out of here, you'll be too old to even get it up.
68 days, buddy. 68 days.
What the fuck you talking about, 68 days? That's in jail, sucker. You still don't know where you at, man.
Yeah, where am I at, Washington?
With us, baby. You're with us. And you're gonna stay with us until we let you go.
Do you want to say something to the group, Mr. McMurphy?
Well, yeah. I'd like to know why none of the guys never told me that you, Miss Ratchet, and the doctors could keep me here till you're good and ready to turn me loose.
Michael and I had an assistant, one of the patients, a kid about 23, 24, good-looking kid, about 6 foot. Any one of us would be happy to have him as a son, a brother, nephew, cousin, friend, you know. Just a good kid. His problem was he didn't think people liked him. How do you explain it? You can't. They're trying to get him to understand it in the hospital. So we worked with him. At the end of a picture, he said he wanted, near the end, he wanted to talk to us, to Michael and me. He said, I found out you treat everyone the same, that you don't look at him as being special, that if he does something good, you tell him it's good. If it's wrong, you say, that's wrong. You should get this done this way because it doesn't work that way. He said, you tell me things about that I did wrong, and then you'd also tell me about things I did right. And we really both of us were crying. And then we came back with the finished picture because we promised them at the hospital that the patient, that we'd show them the picture. And we didn't. This kid was now out of the hospital 6 months later.
Cheswick, You're voluntary?
The line of Jacks, you should be out of here. You're voluntary. That's one of the key parts of the picture, which is the truth about it. Over half of the ward we were in were voluntary. Had committed themselves.
Billy, for Christ's sakes, you must be committed, right? You're just a young kid. What are you doing here? You ought to be out in a convertible with bird, dog, and chicks.
Maybe 80-90% of them, except for their one aberration, whatever that aberration is, are the same as you, and which caused the lines. Bo got that where he said, you're no crazier than the average asshole walking around on a street.
What do you think you are, for Christ's sake? Crazy or something? Well, you're not. You're not. You're no crazier than the average asshole out walking around on the streets, and that's it. Jesus Christ, I can't even believe it.
We really didn't like Big Nurse. We really didn't like her.
Very challenging observations you made, Randy.
Her character, yeah, she was evil.
I'm sure some of the men would like to comment.
And we loved her, because she's one of the sweetest persons you'll ever meet. And the kind of heart that you wish every woman would have and hope they have. And yet we hated her at that time. So good and evil, you know, represented a kind of evil that by not being loud.
May I have my cigarettes, please, Miss Ratchet?
You sit down, Mr. Cheswick, and wait your turn.
We learned every hospital we went to. We went to four hospitals.
Go ahead.
To find a place, and we ended up at in Salem, Oregon, because it was the only place the doctors there had read the book, and we found out the governor of the state had read the book when we met him, Tom McCall, and he was there in Salem. That was the capital, so he was there, and we met him at the time, and the other guy who succeeded him, Staub, was a wonderful guy to be with, governor. And they read the book, and every hospital every one of the four, Michael and I kept talking about it, how it was true, because we always traveled together and going to places. We had a lot of time to talk. And every hospital said, we have a big nurse here.
Remember, it
could be a male doctor, male orderly, or a woman doctor, or a woman orderly. And at this hospital, they pointed out, Dean Brooks said, that's our nurse Ratchet. I'm not going to describe her or anything, that's our nurse Ratchet. He said, she's wonderful, but we have to watch her all the time.
Mr. Cheswick, you sit down!
Yes, but I want to know...
Sit down, Mr. Cheswick.
I want to...
Give him a cigarette, will you, Harding?
Jack is not only a great actor, he's also a smart actor. Because he knows that better the people around him will be, he will be better. And also the whole, as I said, you know, the whole atmosphere there was really, you know, we were group. And it's not easy several weeks to be confined to a mental institution, you know. And so I guess it was the instinct to, you know, save the sanity was to, you know, be friendly and have a good relationships between each other. He was wonderful. He was, you know, like, not always, but, you know, quite often, you know, star, you know, in front of the camera, then you turn around. So he goes into the camper, or I say the lines, you know, or his stand-in says the lines. No, Jack was always there behind the camera and, you know, playing the lines for the actor in front of the camera.
Yes, Mr. Cheswick?
I asked you a question.
I heard your question, Mr. Cheswick, and I will answer your question as soon as you've calmed down.
Okay.
Are you calm, Mr. Cheswick?
I'm calm.
Good.
Well, you know, like the details in materials contribute to the authenticity of period. So details of human reaction contribute very much to authenticity of life on the screen.
You
know, it's very important, you know, because sometimes you can play on reaction, you know, more strongly what the scene is about than what the main actor in that scene is talking about.
How are we going to win our money back?
You're not going to win your money back, Mr. Martini. That's all over.
This happened to me in Prague. You know, I was standing on the sidewalk waiting for a streetcar, and you know, a bunch of people around me also, and somebody must have thrown away a burning butt of a cigarette on the ground, but it ended up in a cuff of my pants. And let me tell you, when suddenly I felt this burning sensation on my leg, it was the most incredible jolt, and I went into a panic. And so I started to scream and jump around, and people are looking like me, I'm crazy, so I put it in the film. I was very nervous before shooting this scene because I never staged a fist fight, and I always admire American movies, how wonderful the fist fights are. But I didn't have to be nervous because, you know, Jack and Nathan George, when they went on it, you know, they taught me how to stage a fight.
we need this chair. Just move right over there. Okay. I see Mr. Brown's back. Yes.
Okay. Don't bother me.
Mr. McMurphy.
How do you do, Mr. McMurphy?
I'm real fine.
I know you didn't do anything wrong. Just sit down. They're not going to hurt. Just sit down right here. That's it. First, this is Mr. Cheswick, and he's a little upset.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. You'll be okay, Mr. Cheswick.
Yeah.
Would you keep an eye on him?
Now, this is the only scene where everybody, the patients, the orderlies, the nurses, and the doctor will come in. Everybody except the three actors, of course, are real people from the hospital, are real patients. All these people are real patients, orderlies, and nurses.
We'll be all right.
Come on.
No!
You're all right. No one's going to hurt you.
No! Leave me! No!
Make it easy on yourself.
No!
Come on.
No! No! No!
Come on. Come on. Come on.
No!
Come on.
No! I did do justice! Back! No! I won't go! I don't want to go!
When he's going in to get his electric shot, when the Indian first talks, he hits Will Sampson with his elbow to get his attention and gives him a piece of gum. And Will says,
"Thank you."
First he says, "Thank you." And he turns and looks at Will and doesn't say anything. He's astounded. Then he hits Will again with his elbow. Like, that starts the machinery and makes him talk. You know, he doesn't have to hit him. He could say, "How are you? You know, what's going on?" So he hits him with his elbow. And the second time, he says, "The juicy fruit." And well, he said, "You sly son of a bitch." He said, "You can talk to." And when that take was over, I went to Jack. I said, "That was great hitting him the second time, like you needed to do that to start the machinery." And Jack said, "No, no." He said, "That son of a bitch, Bo Goldman, wrote it." He was so enthused about someone having the intelligence to write something. Because when you realize writing it, think about writing that now.
Christ. You fooled him, Gene. You fooled him. You fooled him all.
I remember it as being a great scene in the book, in the novel, and being so pleased that the scene where the chief speaks for the first time was as good and better than we envisioned it. Jack's reaction to Will speaking was so great. It was just wonderful, and that excitement was so spectacular. When we saw that in dailies, we laughed out loud. It gave us such joy. And I remember that it was such a wonderful juxtaposition as to what was going to happen next, which was the shock treatment.
Murphy?
Huh?
Please follow me.
You know, when you're in a hospital psychiatric ward for as long as we have, And then when you're going up to the shock treatment session, we were trying to find a way to kind of raise the odds, to raise the ante, as if you're going into Dante's Inferno. And so Milo's tried very hard to create a more edgy, dangerous quality with those people when you got up there, which played against the moment of the two of them, Jack and Will, sitting on the bench before the famous juicy fruit.
There might be a little fluid in them boots, you know what I mean, boys? Still a little leak. Light shine, boys, and send the specimen to Nurse Ratched.
And this is the way how the electroshocks were administered in the early 60s, in the late 50s and early 60s still.
Okay, this won't hurt, and be over in just a moment.
Uh-huh. What's that?
Conductant.
A little dabble, do you? Right, Mr. Jackson?
Open your mouth.
What's that?
This will keep you from biting your tongue.
That was a very exhausting day for Jack. I remember Milos did that a number of different times, that take. And it was very effective, but was a very tough day. We love this project so much that we had certain expectations, but as we interviewed different directors to take on this task, we were disappointed by how much the directors sort of kind of kept their cards to themselves, as if they weren't really going to tell us what they were planning on doing. And we instinctually felt that we wanted to be a part of this process. And I think Saul and I never forget the first time that we met Milos after he'd seen the script and liked it. And he came out, and the first time he came to my house in Los Angeles, and he sat down with Saul and I, and he opened the first page, and he proceeded to tell us exactly what he was thinking of doing.
He was the only one who told us what we had been telling each other we really wanted in a picture. He said it must be real, it has to be. For the audience to believe it, to be involved, it has to be real.
What helped me to getting the job was my European experience. Because as I found out here, nobody, before you have a contract, reveals ideas. Because it could be stolen, right? Well, you know, in Europe it's the other way around. So I knew that what's expected from me when I meet with Saul and Michael, you know, to tell them how I would do the film. So I did my homework. So I sat down with them and I took the book and I got page by page telling them this I would change this way, this I would eliminate, this I would add, this, through the whole book, you know. And that, I guess, impressed them. And
I remember this incredible feeling of relief came over both Saul and I that we had truly found a partner, and recognized through Milos just how much he knew that we loved this project.
Perfect, Billy boy, absolutely perfect. They was giving me 10,000 watts a day, you know, and I'm hot to trot. Next woman takes me on, gonna light up like a pinball machine and pay off in silver dollars.
See, in books you can stop when you're reading, you can go back and you can invent things. Books are usually about thought, a person's thinking. Well, in film, you're seeing a face, and only a great actor can make you, like Jack, can make you believe he's thinking and get it to you.
Jack is renowned as a team player, as a wonderful actor that he is. He creates an environment for all of the other actors, the supporting roles, to be as comfortable as possible. And is very similar to the character of McMurphy in the actual movie. But he will move around, and he's got a nickname for every actor, and he'll call them all the nicknames, and really works hard at creating an environment where everybody is comfortable and relaxed. I think he has learned, as I have, you know, over the years, that as good as we are individually, it's only as good as the whole picture is, and therefore you don't ever want a weak link. You want everybody to be as good as possible. So he's just totally committed, and he's a director's dream in that he will give anything and will always look out for his fellow actors.
And John Hall were arrested Sunday and are being held in custody in Alabama by state police on charges of illegal possession of dynamite. Police say the men will be held on this misdemeanor charge pending full investigation.
Yeah, baby, smack. It's on tonight.
You know, it was so funny because, you know, suddenly, this is a Czech movie. This is a movie about society I just lived 20 years of my life. You know, it's about everything I know. And I know how these people feel. You know, because it's a... You know, we create institutions to help us live. Right? We even pay them with our own money to help us live, right? And we always end up being owned and dictated by these institutions, as if they are paying us to be obedient, you know? And I was very passionate about the book. Besides, it's a great story and great characters and great personalities in the story. It has this kind of message for me, you know?
Chief, I can't take it no more. I gotta get out of here.
I love this man, Will Sampson, the Indian.
I can't.
I just can't. You know, sometime around this time, and we were practically a few days before the end of the shooting, and he came to me, and he was a very quiet man always, but always on time, always knowing his lines, you know, always, you know, not, never any problem. And he came to me and he said, Milos, listen, the part I'm playing in this film, is it a big part? And I looked at him and said, well, you know, this is the second biggest part in the movie. Do you think I should now move to Hollywood? And I said, Will, listen, you know, go back to Yakima, because if they want you in Hollywood, they will find you even if you will be on the North Pole. And if they don't want you, you can be sitting under their noses and nobody will pay any attention. So go back and you'll see. And we finished shooting, and a week later I learned that Will is living in Los Angeles and his telephone number is unlisted.
Hold him, sitting, ditch your ass back in bed.
Scatman Crothers came to our cast via Jack Nicholson. Jack was looking at the script and knew that part of the orderly and thought that Scatman would add the right kind of humor and energy to that role. And on top of that, when you're an ensemble cast like we were, you know, working together for so many months, it's so important to have a group that gets along. And Scatman, besides being right for the part, he gave so much to the whole company. He always had his little ukulele and his little guitar. He always had a song for the Scatman, always had a song kind of to cheer people up and to talk. But he got a little bleak up there. And I think that it really paid off. It was over a 6 or 7 month casting period that Milos went through, you know, refining and reducing the groups down to our final actors. And one of the important elements is not only talent, but being pleasant to work with. And we were very fortunate in having a great company. And Scatman, he just was such a positive man. He always made you smile and gave us a lot. So I have to thank Jack Nicholson for making that recommendation.
This looks like my high school. Oh, hey, I take that. The barber chair.
You may have.
Great actor, Scatman Crothers. Is one of Jack's friends. That was, you know, it was interesting because before we started shooting, Jack came to me and said, listen, let me give you a list of my friends, and if you can use any one of them, that would be nice. And he gave me a list like 15 people. And I was thinking, well, I'll see them, of course, but if will Jack be angry if they will not fit and I will not use them? Will that cause any friction or whatever?
Very interesting.
And about 7 or 8 of his friends are in the movie. Scatman is one of them. But most of the others were just the chronic patients on the ward. You even didn't notice them in the film very much. But I realized that it was a very good idea because it made everybody feel more like a family, and Jack was more relaxed having his friends around, and I was happy that he's happy, and the other actors were happy that I am happy, and it worked fine.
Row your boat gently down the stream.
The party scene, first of all, I remember it was a breath of fresh air because we had some girls in the picture. Not to say that Nurse Ratched and our nurses, but they were always playing the roles of the, you know, power brokers, and all of a sudden there were these party girls in the movie. And it was very, very well staged by Milos in terms of the girls' arrivals and the whole relationship with putting the girls, you know, Maria Small Candy together with Billy Bibbit. And it had this, you know, wonderful mixture of poignancy of fun, which then turns into tragedy with them not leaving in time and McMurphy not escaping. But everybody was ready for that scene. They were ready to have a party. And I think everybody was coming up with lots of wonderful imaginative ideas of how to wheel around on wheelchairs. And we're truly into, at that point in the movie, having a party.
Oh, shit, the supervisor! Come on, get your ass back in there! Come on! Come on there!
Well, that's no talking so much. Is he in there? Good. Come on.
They needed a break. It was a tough, long picture. We did shoot the party scene towards the end of our stay at the hospital, and they enjoyed it. And because of the windows outside, we shot a lot of it at night during the evenings, and it worked very well.
Mr. Turkle?
Milos's theory, which is a theory of a lot of people, but not voiced as well, he said when you write a book, you do a lot of research and a lot of work, trying out a lot of things, a lot of sources. You have source material here, source material there, and all kinds of source material to write that book. When you make a film, it's another form, and the book then becomes source material. And if you can make these characters who are in the book more visual, because they're invented. Milan Kundera said something to me once. He said, I'm very nervous about seeing the picture because they will have faces now. And he will see them for the first time with real faces, and the rest of the time, from then on, he will see those people as those faces. It made him nervous. Not afraid or anything, but nervous about it. And you understand it's different. They are different there. And if you can get the essence of a book and the spirit, and even something more, because the truth isn't only what they have in a book. The truth of this person's character can be many other things that an actor can do. Something, I didn't even put the actor in the equation before, but he becomes part of the equation by just looking, turning just a little bit. As you know, as an editor, what it means, the inflection in the voice. The voice inflection is your inflection when you read the book. You give them that. But when you put it on a screen, it becomes someone else's. Plus, he has a writer and someone else to judge him, a director and an editor.
Well, you know, I decided that, you know, that I want absolutely unknown faces in the mental institution, because it was absolutely proper to have a star, to have a Jack, you know, because he represents us, our world, and we are entering the world of unknown mental institution. And so that's where I wanted, you know, that everybody, you know, unknowns, right? And I interviewed over 1,000 actors for all the parts.
Danny DeVito. Danny and I started acting professionally and were roommates together in New York a few years before that. Danny was appearing as Martini in the off-Broadway version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in New York. And as it turned out, Danny was the first person that was cast. Christopher Lloyd, I knew through his brother, this kind of crazy quality that his brother had. Michael Barryman, who played Ellis, is a lovely gentleman who had a particular physicality that we needed for lobotomy, and was very effective at that. William Duhl, who played Seafelt, a stage actor, does a lot of work. Vincent Schiavelli, who played Fredrickson. Vinny is in a lot of Milos's movies, a wonderful intellect. Joseph Elitch, Bencini, I'm tired, I'm really tired. Lovely New York actor. Dwight Marfield is a lovely actor. Ellsworth, the one who's the old man who's sort of dancing around all the time.
None of them was heavily overloaded with experience, you know. Brad Dourif, Milos saw in Red Rider, When You Come Home, and he loved him in the play, and he got him. A couple of guys were from here in the play. Scanlon with the beard and the box. He was from the play at the Little Fox here. Sidney had done just about nothing, Sidney Lassett. And one time he got the part, because one day he came to rehearsal, instead of a belt, he had a rope around, like, you know, the clothesline for his belt. His belt broke and something, so he couldn't get anything. So I told Milos, Milos and I were talking about it, I said, that's getting him the part. He says, it has a lot to do with him getting the part, you know.
Maria Small, who played Candy, was just cast right. She was the right person for the job. And then Brad Dourif, of course, as Billy Bibbit. That was the first film he'd ever done, and was a wonderful discovery and very talented. Louisa Moritz played Rose. She was great, lovely actress. Will Sampson was the real thing, and I thought was the most fortunate piece of casting we found. Peter Bracco is a wonderful Broadway stage actor out of New York that we were familiar with. The Warren, who was one of the orderlies, Mwako Kambuka, I just remember Mwako Kambuka, and I asked him, what does that mean? He said, that means blaze in Swahili. So I said, okay, that's good to know. Nathan George, who played Washington. I had done an off-Broadway play with Nathan George, in which I remember he pulls a knife on me in the play, and I had to get it away from him. And I remember him making it very difficult for me to get him away, and he had a kind of a tough, mean streak that we thought would be just, you know, right for this, and he was very effective. And he's a good actor, Nathan George. Ken Kenny, Beans, is a good friend of Jack Nicholson's, and did a nice job, and he came up there to really kind of be associated with Jack. Ted Marklin is also a good friend of Jack's. He played Hap.
I'm gonna miss you very much, Mac.
Chris had done theater. I saw Chris, I think I told you, doing Kurt Weill's Happy End with Meryl Streep. They were the two leads. So he was well known, and a lot of the other guys were stage people floating around. Dwight Marfield, the white-haired guy floating around in the back. Peter Bracco, his play and film. Most of those guys were a preponderance of play backgrounds, I think.
What do you say?
Redfield had been done both, but mostly theater. I had seen him actually in Tea and Sympathy with Deborah Carr in New York in a play there. And I knew of him, and I'd heard of him here and there. And we saw him in New York, and Milos cast him. And he thought he'd be perfect for Harding. Then we, about a month in a play, he started coughing. He had a cold, a bad cold. And we thought it was a bad cold. And
it was a difficult situation in that we found out that he had a serious blood disease about halfway through the movie, and that he was dying, and had to make the decision whether to replace him and then reshoot everything we had shot up to that time, or to gamble that he could get through the film and we would all be okay.
You want a date with him?
Dr. Spivey, on the set. He examined him and said, he called Michael and me in and said, he has leukemia. You know, they took his blood tests and everything else, and he said he probably will live about 18 months. His wife came in, Linda, and she made a great defense of him. That's the best part he's ever had in film. And even now I get goosebumps thinking about it. Because it really was great. It was very touching, she was crying, but in her soul, it wasn't just a pitch. And then we had Dean Brooks, who would play Dr. Spivey, who was the head of the hospital. We asked him, and what could he do? We told Milos, of course. Then he knew, everyone knew. And he said he could go through the picture if he takes care, if you take care, and everything else. He said it's just pneumonia is the only thing he would have to worry about. So we said, okay, we'll go. We'll take a chance.
We mutually decided together that to go for it.
And we got through the picture, and almost, it was 18 months later, almost to the day, like a week away, that he died. Yeah, he did see it. We took him to Washington, D.C. after it came out. It was a big thing down there. And we took him to a couple of cities where we are having premieres, you know, and benefits. And he was in his glory. He loved it. And it was great because people recognized him in the theater. A lot of theater people came and all of that. And the cheers and applause. And Jack Nicholson. Everyone in the business knew he was a great actor. And performed and been great in movies, in certain movies. But the public still didn't know him. We went up to Oregon one time. And people with Michael, Jack, and myself were going up there. Milos was there. And people would come up to Michael for an autograph and bypass Jack and not say anything to him. Michael's a TV star. Jack didn't exist for him. I had a well-known critic up there say to me, well, if this picture works, will you sign Jack up to a long-term contract in case he became a star? You know, and I'm looking, my God, where am I? You know, He's a star now. You don't know it. That's all. The people didn't know it. Cuckoo's Nest made him a popular star. That's the only difference. And, he still was a great... If you saw Last Detail, he's a guy who could stand still and you know what's going on in his mind, what he's thinking, and you're thinking with him. That kind of acting is very hard.
I've always wanted to take, you know, a 1,000-foot reel of film is about 10 minutes long. And, for instance, we have, scenes where the camera is on Jack Nicholson, who does not say one word. And the camera runs for 10 minutes, and you never get tired of watching him. And I've always thought, and I've learned this from my father, that the sign of a really good actor is a listener, he who listens well. And Jack is extraordinary. And the same thing can be said with a lot of the other actors. So we knew that this was good. It was really good. We had no idea if there was an audience out there or if it was going to be commercial. Because it was such a wacky picture and such an odd assortment of characters, there's a whole bunch of war stories to talk about.
Well, we had a funny story at the beginning. Everyone was saying the picture wouldn't be made. It's an independent company. They're not going to have the money, blah, blah, blah. So we sent the money up like 2 weeks in advance to the bank. The first couple payrolls and everything else we sent up there in a bank account, established it with our bank here and references and everything else. The first checks that went out bounced. The first ones. So they came running to the office. And it's impossible. I said they can't bounce because I know. They credited to another account. They made a mistake at the bank. And we went down and told them they had to send out letters to these people who got these checks. They didn't want to do that because they had to admit an error. So we said, you have to or we'll sue you. Then they did it. I don't mind the fifth or sixth, there's a problem. They know we paid. They hadn't gotten the paycheck, you know.
Mr. Miller, show this woman the way out of the hospital.
Gladly. Come on, lady, let's go.
Oh.
You're going home.
Oh, where?
Let her go, Scanlon. You're going home.
And Mr. Washington?
Yes, Miss Reggie.
Make sure no one is missing.
Will do.
That's when we brought Bill Butler on, and that was about 5 or 6 weeks into the picture. Bill Butler had to leave. He had a commitment back east. A good TV show was Trial by... No, it was a good TV show. It was a documentary-type TV show, one of those Playhouse 90 type things. And he had to go anyway. We knew that when we started.
Move it!
Do you know Camera Cinematographers Union or Guild? The credit, you can only allow one credit for cameraman unless somebody dies. At the top. And it's the one who worked the most days. He gets the credit up front. And if you use later, you can use some phrases in the credit, the final credit.
I want an answer to my question. Did he leave the grounds of the hospital?
Haskell worked 31 days. Bill Butler worked 30 days. And Bill Fraker came in and shot the boat scenes.
Mr. Washington?
Yes.
Ms. Hildreth?
Haskell got credit as the DP.
Mr. Warren?
Yes.
Ms. Stark in the tub room. Mr. Martini? May I have my cap, please? My cap. There. Thank you.
I think the beauty of Nurse Ratched is it was a concept that was carried over into all sorts of businesses and works. I mean, lots of companies have that Nurse Ratched woman in some key control position that you don't cross. It's not a sexist remark. It's just a kind of a type of character, and that's sort of the beauty to see a picture like this where an archetype is created that people call her the Nurse Ratched of our company. And you see it exist all over the place in very, very many different companies.
Bradley, I'll tell you, we had in mind an actor for Billy Bibbit, who was excellent, wonderful. But then I saw in a play off Broadway, When Are You Coming Back, Red Rider, a play. And there I saw Brad Dourif. And I was absolutely mesmerized by this young man because I already was working on the film, on the script for Cuckoo's Nest, how he didn't have to act. He was Billy Bibbit. And that was the great, important difference, you know, because the actor we had was a brilliant, absolutely brilliant actor, and his Billy Bibbit was just a showcase of brilliant acting. But here was somebody who was Billy Bibbit. You didn't see the acting. And that what fascinated me, and the collaboration with Brad,
you know, Billy, what
was wonderful.
Is how your mother's going to take this.
Brad Dourif was an inspiration. He was one of those actors, again, from the first time he came in for a reading. He was so real, we weren't quite sure whether he was going to make it through the movie or not. As it turned out, he was lovely and wonderful, but it was just a tremendous reading that, again, I think became one of our early favorites.
Please, don't tell my mother.
Don't you think you
should
have thought of that before you took that woman in that room?
No. I didn't.
You mean she dragged you in there by force?
What he does, which is marvelous with actors, he lets them do what they think they should be doing when they read the scene first. He says, if I don't let them do it, what they think they should be doing, they'll be afraid of me. And if I tell them to do something, half of them will only do it that way the rest of the time. He said, and in my stupid head, as he says, I could be wrong, you know. And the funny thing about that, years later, I worked with Anthony Minghella on English Patient. He did the exact same thing. But Anthony, very British, well-mannered, if they do something wrong, he'll walk up quietly, put his arm around their shoulder, and say, you know, before this, he's thinking so-and-so. And Milos has been known to say, that's stage bullshit you're giving me. You cannot lie to the camera. And he's right. I call him a lot because he's a great teacher, Milos. Great teacher.
Put Billy in Dr. Cooney's office.
No.
Stay with him till the doctor arrives.
No.
One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest was such a unique and magical experience for all of us. We went against the odds in every way. It was a truly an independent picture, financed by Fantasy Films. We made the picture without having a distributor in place. We spent a lot of time up there in Salem, Oregon, hanging out together, and there was a definite bond that was created. And then the end results is something that's a picture that's probably the most important picture in almost every one of our resumes. It was a picture that, you know, won the top five Oscars. And at the time, there was only one other picture that had won Best Picture, Best Director, best actor, best actress, best screenplay. And so I think it's a memory that we can look back upon that brings us nothing but fond, good memories, both personally as well as a sense of success.
Washington, to the day room. Immediately.
Put down those keys and nobody gets hurt. Move away from the window and take that damn chief.
For the big nurse. That was interesting because, she is the evil. She is the personified evil in the story. And we were all, Saul and Michael, convinced that we have to have somebody who is really personification of, brutal force and strength and evil. And as a matter of fact, we offered the part, one after another, of course, to about four actresses who would, fill this image.
The interesting thing about the character of Nurse Ratched, and it's really a sort of a sign of the times, is that none of the actresses wanted to play a villain. This was the beginning of the women's movement, and we had a number of actresses, five actresses, very top flight actresses at that time, all who turned this part down. Milos couldn't believe it, Saul and I couldn't understand it, but there was something about the image of a woman being a villain that was inappropriate for that time in the women's movement. Now you ask a male actor, and most of us have had our best careers playing a villain, but so be it. And Milos one time saw a Robert Altman film where Louise Fletcher had a small part in it, and he took a look at this and showed it to us and said, let's take a look.
I met Louise Fletcher, and I slowly, it was not immediate, decision, I slowly started to realize that it will be much more powerful if it's not this visible evil, that she's only an instrument of evil. She doesn't know that she is evil. She, as a matter of fact, believes that she's helping people. And she is soft, and she is very gentle, and she is, in certain way, an angel. Because then it's scary.
And she came in for an interview with us, and she had just the right quality, and was a great discovery, and we were so happy that out of that she won the Oscar for Best Actress, and also thankful for Milos doing his homework. She had a wonderful sense of humor, and it was a very difficult part to play because everybody hated Nurse Ratched, and she was this sort of uptight. And there was, I believe, one moment where she kind of opened up her nurse's front, kind of flashed her group therapy sessions and the end of some long day as a sense of a kind of comic relief I think everybody appreciated.
He beat up two of the attendants and escaped.
This is Bill Redfield, very good actor and a heroic man, because when we were shooting the film, he was already very, very sick, and we didn't know about it. As a matter of fact, in the middle of the shooting, we had to stop because he had, which I was told was just a mild bout of pneumonia. He came back, finished the film, and then later he died a few months after we finished the film.
Thank you.
I really believe there's a spirit that infects a movie when you want to try to make something good.
Our first public screening of the picture in Berkeley, California, that we knew there was something very special.
We got you. After we made the picture, we had knew we made a good picture. We really did. Because we knew at the beginning we were making a good picture. Because everybody believed. And you believe those nine guys sitting in front of you. You really believe them. And Jack is superb. When you watch him day after day, he's a superb actor. And good to work with. The other actors loved him. And they still do. The people who work with him talk about him all the time.
Shouldn't underestimate the small screens.
Now we can make it, Mac.
Because on a big screen you can see very clearly that there are scars on McMurphy's forehead. That means, you know, that he underwent lobotomy. But on a small screen, not everybody notices it. And then people might ask, you know, what happened to him. Might think that he's just faking it like he did once before after electroshocks. So, I regret that I didn't make it more pronounced so that there is no confusion. They were shooting the scene where he kills Jack, and you see that Jack has a lobotomy, and you know that he's gone. He's going to be a zombie for the rest of his life. And the Indian puts it on me. He says, "Let's go," when he kills him. And you knew you had it. And people were, actors were there. I remember Louise was there crying, and a couple of guys in the circle were crying.
Thank you. the Indian scene, Will Sampson scene, was so powerful. So powerful when, in the first place, everyone came to work. He was the only one working, but the crew, it was a small crew working, but every other member of the crew, every actor was standing there like baseball game, you know, outside there. When Milos yelled cut, the cheer went up like he was getting out. Yeah, it was great. It still is exciting. Milos came over after he did that. He said, "That scene is so powerful." He said, "I'd like an extra hour or two to make a scene that shows the reaction, because the audience will need a little time." And he said, "It wouldn't take more than an hour." I said, "Milos, nothing ever took you an hour or two." So he did that. They came up with a scene. First it was Chris, and then they get the other guys out there, put them in bed and take shots of them. Chris was great, that last move of his. And it's what neat is like a catharsis of a kind. That's just the right touch.
Jack Nietzsche, as I remember, was a suggestion that came to us from Art Garfunkel, who was a good friend of mine and talked about it. And I'll never forget going to Fantasy Films in Berkeley, California, one day to hear a recording session. And as I arrived in the parking lot of Fantasy Films, there was this old pickup truck, like just an old, like 40s pickup truck with a big old guy with bib overalls. And he was picking up out of the back of his truck one of these huge old timber saws for cutting down big trees. And I said, "What's this?" And the guy said, "You know where I can find Jack Nietzsche?" I said, "You mean Jack Nietzsche?" He says, yeah, he's in there. I said, "What's going on here?" So I go on into the recording studio, and I go into the engineer's room, and I look in the studio, and there I see Jack with glasses of water. He's got different glasses of water, and he's going, "Okay, let's take another take." And he's putting his finger around the top of the glasses, because and he's basically playing these different glasses at different tones. And then the next thing, this farmer walks in with this saw, and he starts recording. Wow. And I thought we were in deep trouble. I thought that we maybe had made a terrible mistake, and I thought we were definitely in the middle of a nut house. And lo and behold, it was one of the best scores I've ever heard in a film.